All right, let's get started. As usual, let me start by asking if you had any questions on the intellectual property stuff we did last time. The final bit of that, which I don't remember if any of it is in the book, because some of it is stuff that came up afterwards, is the issue of how you produce intellectual property if you don't have intellectual property law. That is, if you can't enforce copyright law, for example. And I think that's becoming increasingly an issue with regard to intellectual property in digital form, because it's so easy to copy and distribute it. And one answer is tie-ins, that you give away the movie and sell the stuffed animals, or you give away the book and sell your services as a consultant after using the book to establish your reputation. Or you give away the software and sell the only computer the software will run on, to take Apple's example in the past. Another sort of interesting solution is open source, the way in which Linux and a variety of other useful things were produced. I don't remember if I mentioned it last time, but there's a sense in which the academic world has been running on open source for a century or two, or maybe longer, in that when a professor writes an article, he doesn't normally get any income from writing the article. He gets the income from the reputation that he's created by publishing articles. And he's expected to provide, to make available, the data on which his conclusions are based, which is like the source material, as it were, the source code for a program. So those are points which I think I touched on briefly, and I just wanted to mention again, because they're likely to be of increasing importance in your lifetime. Yep.
For like an open source, right? Obviously, yep. There's open source and there's for-profit software. And then when I compare it to open source academic world, what would be the pay software version of the academic world? Would that be like managed consultants or things like that, where they're doing the same sort of work, but they're charging a lot of money?
But also textbooks.
Textbooks.
You distinguish between journal articles and textbooks. A successful textbook, I don't know about the average textbook, certainly the only real textbook I wrote didn't make very much money, but the very successful ones, you know, I'm pretty sure Greg Mankiw has more than enough income to live comfortably on from his textbook, and I expect Samuelson did back when it was the top one. I suspect the same is true for some of the others. Other questions, comments? All right. Next, do you have questions on the chapter on contract that you read for today? I'd rather discuss whatever things you had problems with than just try to summarize what's in it. So, if there was anything you didn't understand, someday I will teach a course by saying, if you have any questions, you don't understand everything in the chapter. You did? Good. Goodbye. Save everybody a bunch of time. In theory, at least, the next time people will either have questions ready or maybe they won't. But nothing, no particular things in the chapter that you wanted to have explained or discussed? So, the first question really is why you have contracts at all. And if you think of the sort of simplest spot sale where I hand over some money while you hand over some goods, that doesn't need a contract. I don't remember if I mentioned it in the book, but there's evidence of a form of silent auction which goes back, I think, to Africa, maybe BC, I'm not sure, where you have traders who come to a place where people in Africa have gold or ivory or something valuable. They may have no language in common, so how do you bargain? The traders make a pile of stuff that are offering in exchange. The villagers make a pile of stuff they're willing to trade for it. If the traders find that inadequate, the traders take away some of their stuff to reduce their offer. Both sides readjust the piles, as it were, until agreement is reached, at which point one side goes off with one pile and one side with the other. And part of what's interesting is that that looks like a case where it's a reputational enforcement that prevents one side from just taking two piles and vanishing, since then the traders won't come back if the villagers do it, and the villagers won't make any piles next time if the traders do it. And there's actually an interesting article, which maybe at some future time I'll assign for this, discussing much more recent, I think maybe 18th or 19th century, or a little bit earlier than that, trading in Africa of that sort, in which you had no enforceable legal system, you had trading, And my memory is that it starts breaking down at the point when the slave trade arrives. Because at that point, the villagers have to worry that they themselves are a valuable asset. That is, if the asset is gold and elephant tusks, if the traders behave badly, the villagers don't bring anything out next time. It's a good deal harder for the villagers to hide themselves if the traders come and decide to seize them. But in any case, that would be... was an article by Peter Leeson, who has a book out on piracy called The Invisible Hook, and who's also done quite a lot of interesting articles on his webpage. I'm curious. Anyway, so going back to exchanges, in many relationships, performance occurs over time, so we need to specify, if I do this, you'll do this, then I'll do this kind of thing. Even in a single exchange, there may be multiple dimensions to performance. What is the quality of these apples? What variety of apples they are? Am I paying you in gold or in dollars or in something else? Am I paying you right now or some of it later and so forth? And so anyway, so there are reasons why one would have a contract. One of the problems with contracts is opportunistic breach, which is discussed at some length in the chapter. That is the case. There are, in a sense, two reasons you can see why a contract gets breached. One of them is because circumstances change such that the same terms that I agreed to initially are now worse than nothing to me, so I back out. And the other is opportunistic breach, which is a situation where nothing has changed. It's just that you've performed your half of the contract and I have performed mine, so I can walk away with the benefit without the cost. And one of the obvious problems is how do you prevent opportunistic breach? And we'll be talking more about that next time, because the reading for next time includes my piece From China to Cyberspace, which is a piece that came out really from two different seminars I taught here, one of them on legal issues of the 21st century and one of them on legal systems very different from ours. And the legal system is very different. We discussed the Imperial Chinese law, and one of its interesting features was that you really didn't have contract law. You didn't really have civil law in our sense at all, only criminal law. So that if I lend you money and you don't pay it back, all I can really do is to report you to the district magistrate as a swindler. Nonetheless, in spite of that, they had very elaborate contractual practice. And that raises the interesting puzzle of how they managed to maintain a functioning system of contract without the law. And that's a question that ought to be of interest even to you, even though you're in a society that does have contract law. Because if you're a really good lawyer, you're drawing up contracts that will never get to court. That is, you want to be able to arrange it so it's never in anybody's interest to have to call on the state to enforce it. And figuring out how to do that is useful to think about how people did it in a society where they couldn't get the state to enforce the contract. And I argue in the article, which you'll be reading for next time, that future transactions in cyberspace may well have the same characteristic, that you're dealing with people in a world where geographic boundaries are invisible, where you may not even know who you're dealing with. People could be dealing anonymously, for example, using encryption and such. Discuss that some. And consequently, you again have the issue, if you're dealing with somebody in a world where you can't sue them in court, how do you arrange your dealings so that nonetheless you have a reasonable, reliably believing their word? And we'll get back to that later. Let me say a little bit, though, about reputational enforcement, which we'll also be discussing there, because it has some interesting characteristics that I think most of you haven't thought about. What I mean by reputational enforcement is the reason you keep the contract is you don't want to have the reputation of being somebody who doesn't keep contracts. And the tricky part about that is, in the case of reputational enforcement, as in the case of speculation, which we'll be discussing later, they both are odd situations economically for the same reason. Because you're getting something desirably done, and people have an incentive to do it, but the incentive has nothing to do with why it's desirable. Does that make sense in the reputational concept? I buy something from a store. The store refuses to take it back, even though they say that they have a return policy. I tell you about how badly the store treated me, and you don't buy anything from the store. That punishes the store. Is the reason that you want to punish the store? What if you don't like me? Maybe you think, ha ha, isn't it great that David finally got his comeuppance? And you know, this fellow who thinks he can rely on firms finally found out the firms, gee, he wasn't that great. Do you buy your next jacket from that store?
No.
Because?
You don't want to get cheated.
You don't want to get cheated. That is to say, the effect is to give firms an incentive to keep their contracts. But the reason for it is the individual's desire to avoid losing out, to avoid being mistreated itself. And that raises a problem. Suppose that you and I have some contractual arrangement, and you break the contract, and I announce to all and sundry that you've cheated me, that you've broken the contract. What are you probably going to do?
If it's true.
True or false? But let's assume it's true for a moment. Are you going to say, yes, indeed, I broke the contract, I'm a bad guy? You might make preparations, but the easy case is that you try to argue that you didn't break the contract, but I broke the contract. That the reason you didn't deliver those goods was that I had changed the terms or not paid on schedule or something. And now suppose you're interested in third party. You're somebody who might want to do business with one of us in the future. And you have no easy way of knowing which of us is telling the truth. What's your response to could it be? What do you, that's right. The rational response is you know one of us is dishonest, you don't know which. And as long as you've got other people to deal with, you might as well avoid both of us. Suppose that I am clever enough to recognize this situation. So if I say he cheated me, I know he cheated me, but I cannot easily prove it. I can prove it maybe because he's willing to go to a good deal of trouble to look at the matter, but you have no reason to go to a good deal of trouble. It's much easier just to buy from him instead. So what am I going to do when he cheats me, given a situation where I have anticipated his response? I'm not going to complain, because complaining only makes it worse. It means that he loses reputation, but I lose reputation too. So what that suggests is that the workability of reputational enforcement critically depends on the cost to interested third parties of finding out who's at fault. And I want to argue that arbitration in many contexts is a mechanism for lowering that cost. That if you imagine the case online in China today, where you and I sign a contract, and in the contract we say, in case of disputes, this contract is to be arbitrated by an arbitrator provided by the American Arbitration Association under their usual rules. And we have a dispute, and the arbitrator says, yes, indeed, you haven't fulfilled your contract, you owe him $10,000 in reparation. If you don't pay, the arbitrator can now tell any interested third person that he was the one at fault, not him. Therefore, as long as the arbitrator has a reputation, the third person doesn't have to go to all the trouble of looking into the details. Therefore, it's my interest to complain. Therefore, it's in your interest not to cheat me in the first place. Right? So that I want to suggest that one useful way of looking at arbitration. See, arbitration in the U.S. at present is usually enforceable in the courts. That has not been true of all forms of arbitration. And the argument I want to make is that to some degree, arbitration is self-enforcing for the reason I just described. That to some degree, at least, an arbitration agreement is a reason to keep your contract, even if the court won't enforce it. Right. Now, I should say, according to what printing of my textbook you have there, you may or may not have an accurate account of Lisa Bernstein's research on the diamond industry. Because the first printing of the hardcover, I made the mistake of writing that paragraph from memory, not of actually rereading her article. And in that printing, at least, I described the arbitrators as being rabbis. And the actual situation, as best I remember, is that at some point prior to Lisa's investigation of the industry, that had been the case. But by the time she looked at it, the function had been taken over by the Diamond Dealers Association of New York, which was a private organization which all of the dealers were members of and which had its own mechanisms. It was still the case that the industry was mostly Orthodox Jews, so people who knew each other and had social ties and such, but that the mechanism was one in which there was an organization which existed in part for the purpose of settling disputes. If you didn't abide by the result that they gave you, then your picture went up in every diamond exchange in the world and you were no longer in the diamond. As a practical matter, because it was a very trust-intensive industry, and therefore people didn't want to deal with people who couldn't be trusted. Yeah?
One feature of arbitration that a lot of especially firms seek lawyers, any sort of well-informed yep. party is the privacy aspect, because you can contract.
Sure.
In fact, that's the default, pretty much.
Sure, but is that still the case if you don't in fact abide by the arbitrated result?
I would think that you pretty much. Yeah, I guess not, but. Like you said, it has the force of law. So
at least in the Diamond case, where it didn't really have the force of law, at least if I remember correctly, your discussion again, I cite the articles. If you want to look at the articles, you can probably find them somewhere. And you shouldn't trust too much my memories of things I've read in the past. But my understanding was that at least in the initial period, that the Orthodox Jews in the industry regarded it as a violation of their religious obligations to sue each other, and therefore really weren't prepared to go to law, but were prepared to use informal mechanisms. So I think you're right that a very common advantage, which is true in the Diamond case as well, because I gather the Diamond dealers have a lot of proprietary information on what they're doing, and therefore one advantage of doing it through a non-court mechanism is that although the fact that you were adjudged by the arbitrator to have acted badly and not compensated as public, assuming that everything goes along smoothly, what the actual facts of the case are never become public, and therefore you can keep your proprietary information about, I don't know what the information is, maybe what price I was willing to sell some particular grade of diamond to you, because I'm hoping to sell it at a higher price to him, but that kind of information. So in any case, all of these points I'm making are relevant in part to the fact that one can have contractual practice without contract law and without courts. Nonetheless, there are clearly areas where contract law and courts can serve a useful purpose. And in any case, you are going to be lawyers practicing not in Imperial China, maybe in cyberspace eventually, but at least for the first part of your career, you'll presumably be practicing in the same legal environment that people now practice in which case you do have to think about issues of contract. All right. Yeah.
I'm not sure if you're going to come to this later, but so I don't want to derail. I had a question about in the chapter that part about the case for freedom of contract.
Yep.
You talk about a bookbinder who
yep.
no binding or gold okay. leaves or whatever, gold pages. And there's one part where it says that improvements that selectively benefit marginal customers
yes. right.
may be made even if not worth making,
right.
while improvements that selectively benefit non-marginal customers may not be made even if worth
right.
making. I understand the second part, but I don't understand
sure.
why.
Sure. Imagine, the point is that if your product is a monopoly, which is the case I'm talking about, if you think about my situation as an author, for example, selling a book which doesn't have close substitutes, which at least I would like to claim my book doesn't. And you can think of each of the potential purchasers as having a value for the book. All right. So imagine you could see the distribution. This is number. Here is a customer who really likes the book. Here is a customer who wouldn't buy the book if you paid it. All right, this is value of the book for the customer. These are customers, and I'm going to order the customers for you now if they like. So you could imagine sort of a curve like this, which represents the distribution. Here, there are a few customers who really like it, some more who like it less, and so forth. If I am, as most sellers are, selling a single price, every customer who likes and values it more than the price buys, and every customer who values it less than less. With the result that this, what's called a marginal value curve, also comes in. But the relevant point is that my revenue is then this price times this one. Right, selling to this many people at this price. Suppose I have a way of changing the book, which will change this curve. I can make changes, some people value it, some don't. Or some people value a lot, some don't. And suppose it were a way of changing it, which made the book a lot more valuable to the people who really like it. All right, detailed index graphs might be really useful to only if you really care about it. But had a negligible effect to the people who found it. What is the effect on my profit, on the revenue that I am getting from the book?
Well, unless I decide that it's not worth raising my price, which I might, but let's here, let's go a little further. Let's suppose that it's only way up here that it's useful. Well, I'm not going to raise the price up here. That cuts out too many customers. So therefore, this change has no effect on what price I can sell it at. Because what I care about are the customers who are just barely willing to pay my price. Hence, if it's costly to make this change, even if the gains of these people more than covers the cost, there's no way I'm going to be able to recoup it. So I won't make it. Whereas turning it around the other way, suppose I had a change. Suppose I decided to dumb down the book. All right? In my doubtless prejudiced view, the greatest weakness of all my books is that they're smart readers. So I'm going to dumb down the book. So now the people who really liked the book, really got into it, it's not much better than any other book. But on the other hand, now the sort of the hoi polloi who didn't much like the book because it was going over their heads, it's more valuable to them. So I can now get lots more money from them, even though I may have actually lowered total length of the book because the cost to these people may be larger than to these people. Alright? So the general argument is that whereas in a competitive industry, any improvement that you make is worth, if it's net value, if it's total value is greater than total cost, it's worth making. In a monopoly, you may have quality either above or below the optimal level, according to how those particular changes affect marginal readers rather than for marginal readers. Does that make sense? That's it. And it's a somewhat subtle point. I'm not sure you will find it in other books on this, but this is sort of an economist kind of point about a kind of inefficiency associated with monopoly, which isn't really that it's anybody's fault, but it's just that the monopolists, and there is, I should say, a solution to this. It's not a perfect solution. But suppose that I am looking at this marginal value curve, and I say, you know, it's really a pity that these guys, my enthusiastic readers, are getting such a great deal and none of which I can buy. What are things I might do to deal with that?
So special.
That's right. I might figure out a way of making a variant of the book. Indeed, I might even say, well, the solution is obvious. We'll have one edition, which isn't going to last for books. It's got a sloppy cover. We're going to call it a paperback. Sell it down here for these people. And then people who really like the book, we're going to have this nice, fancy edition with a hardcover. All right. So that is one way of interpreting hardcovers and paperbacks, that they're what economists call price discrimination, in which you're having a high-quality value to try to tap the greater value to the So, but short of that, if you think of sort of the ordinary case, you're just selling something at one price, then it isn't true that the characteristics are really the optimal ones. Not that they might be, but there's no yep.
So with the price discrimination case, there's no inefficiencies because the firm's capturing the surplus?
Well, with perfect price discrimination, there would be none. The way you do perfect price discrimination, this is getting well off topic, but if you're curious, In my price theory textbook, I do it in terms of a cookie company. And the cookie company is facing a demand curve that looks like this. And their marginal cost producing cookies is this. And they're a monopoly, and they used to price up about here, which turned out to maximize their profit. And then somebody gets really clever and says, here's what we're going to do. This particular kind of cleverness assumes the customers all have identical demand. All identical customers, so the reason for the slope is not that some people like cookies more than others, but that you like your seventh cookie less than your sixth cookie less than your fifth cookie. All right? So what we do is we say, we're going to be really nice to you. We're going to sell cookies at marginal cost at our revenue. There's just one trick, and the one trick is we only sell cookies to members of the cookie club. And the charge for the cookie club is a fixed sum equal to the area under that. That being the total benefit to customers of being able to buy at marginal cost, what's called a consumer surplus in economics texts. So in that way, I'm transferring all of the benefit to me, the seller, and I'm producing the efficient quantity of cookies because I'm producing everybody who values the cookie at least its cost of production is getting it. Right? So that's the extreme case of what's called perfect price distribution.
This might be a question, but what would be the difference between having, say, a hardback and soft edition of the book and having a 50-pack versus an 80-pack of cookies, and then the 80-pack is cheaper per cookie? Is there a difference there? Or is that
oh, I see. Well, there's the hardback paperback version is not trying to work out along one person's demand curve, but it's just trying to separate two groups of customers. And the cookie version, at least, is not. Right? And I guess whether your method worked really depends on whether cookies go stale fast. They don't go stale fast. Everybody buys the 80 and they just buy them less often. But if you imagine that cookies don't last very long and it's not very easy for me to buy an 80 and split it with my friend, then your method might work, but it doesn't do as good a job as this method does.
So, but for whatever, flowers,
yes,
something that won't last more than a week, yep, or something, buying in bulk, if you're, like, say, a wedding caterer versus just a person who wants a dozen roses, would that function the same way?
Except that it might be the case that there are also lower costs producing or selling in bulk.
More.
That's right. It's cheaper to sell lots. If you think going back to paperback and hardcover, the price discrimination argument depends on what I'm almost certain is true, that the price difference between paperback and hardcover is substantially larger than the difference in production cost between paperback and hardcover. Let me give you a different example, which I think I may have mentioned last time, but it's a particularly clear one. And I think I mentioned how Bain sells e-books. Bain Books, science fiction publisher, which got onto the internet very early. And when you publish with Bain, they sell it as a printed book. They sell it as an e-book. But they also sell it as what's called an e-ARC. An ARC is an advanced review copy. And an ordinary ARC means that when your book is written but before the final proofing, they run off sort of preliminary copies to send out to reviewers in order that the reviews will appear about when the book becomes available. Very common. What Bain does is that they have an e-book advanced review copy. And they sell them to enthusiasts at a price which goes down and down as you get closer to publication date. So if you really like some series, and you're waiting for the next one in the series, and you'd like to be able to tell your friends about the next one in the series, especially if they haven't read it yet, then you pay Bain some extra money, and you get it a month early. That's a straight price discrimination case, all right? Because it doesn't cost them any more to deliver it to you early once they got it. So that would be an example. We may get into some more of this stuff from the antitrust, because price discrimination is a possible explanation for a lot of observed behavior on markets. All right, let me go back to what this is really part of, which is the case for freedom of contract. And the basic argument there is that when we're for designing the contract, what we want to do is to maximize the sum benefit and then argue over who gets how much. Therefore, any change would increase the sum benefit. It's in both of our interests to make. We just have to arrange the right side payments to make sure it's in both of our interests. Is that part of the argument clear? Yeah. There are a number of cases in which people question that, correctly or incorrectly. And one which you see a lot of in the law, and which I think is mostly wrong but not 100% wrong, is this idea of superior bargaining. People say, look, you really need what I'm selling. Maybe I'm a monopoly, or maybe I'm not a monopoly, but it's just really important to you, and therefore I can insist on the terms I like. And the argument I offer in the book, which I think is generally correct, is that's wrong. I can't insist on any price I like. If I could, I'd get an infinite amount of money out of people. Anything I do that makes the terms less attractive to you lowers the highest price I can get you to pay, and therefore a change which costs you more than it gives me is ultimately going to make me correct. And a lot of people find that unpersuasive. And I think, thinking about it, I can think of one case which seems to me extraordinarily unlikely, but which I think is behind a lot of the intuitions of why this isn't true, the intuitions of bargaining power. And it's a case in which, in that case, the argument really is right. And that's the man lost in the desert. So let's imagine that I'm lost in the desert and dying of thirst, and I come across you, and you very conveniently have a big barrel of water that you have prudently got out there. And I say, would you mind selling me a little water and telling me which direction to get back to town in? And you say, I'm delighted to do that. How much can you offer? And I say, well, you know, all I've got on me is $50. And you say, well, do you have a checkbook with you? And I say, well, yes. How much do you have in your checking account? Well, I could write you a check for $300 and it wouldn't bounce. too bad for a couple of cups of water. But hey, maybe we can do better. I've got this contract, which I conveniently have pre-drafted, by which you agree to give me 3/4 of your income for the rest of your life in exchange for this water. All right? Now, in a full freedom of contract world, that contract is enforceable. And in that world, I am worse off than if it weren't enforceable. Because if it weren't enforceable, you would settle for the $350, or if the check contract wasn't enforceable, for the $50, and therefore would sell me my water at a lower price. All right? And what's special about this case, and is not true, I think, of most real cases, is it's a case where the wider the range of contracts that are enforceable, the larger the resources that I can pay you. All right? That if no contracts are enforceable, all I can pay you is the money in my wallet. If the contract implicit in writing a check is enforceable, I can pay you that plus the money in my wallet. And if all contracts are enforceable, I can pay you a cent of my lifetime income, minus food and board and such. So in that case, I really am worse off due to freedom of contract. Now, of course, you're better off due to freedom of contract. And I think if you really run through the economics, it's arguable that we are better off. That is, the extortionate price I pay you is a transfer, but the ability to get that extortionate transfer increases your incentive to be sitting there in the desert with a big barrel of water on the very unlikely chance that somebody will come by who you can insist on extorting huge amounts of money from. So it's not even clear that in this case it isn't economically efficient, but it nonetheless is against the interest of one of the parties, which is a good deal of the reason. But as I say, my guess is that a lot of the sort of talk about unequal bargaining power involves people who in the back of their mind are imagining something like that case and are then applying it to the much more common case where it's merely that the seller has something the buyer really wants. And, you know, the...
Two separate questions. First, would that hypothetical be the same as entering an emergency room and you don't have time to make a decision or something?
It would be entering an emergency room in a context where they're the only people who can save you.
But then, let's say it's the only hospital for an hour.
Like, and takes you, and you'll be at an hour.
Yeah, or something.
And then the argument would be that a freedom of contract, which lets you, which will enforce any contract at all, increases the amount that can squeeze out. Now, in that case, of course, it might be fruitful for you to have pre-contracted with that when there were choices to agree to what the terms were on which they treat you. But if you haven't, that issue would.
The other question was, I'm taking insurance law right now, and there's a lot of stuff about, and the freedom of contract is very, very toned down, especially in California in the insurance context. And a lot of that is because the contracts are, if there was pure freedom of contract, the contracts would be very, very technical, and everybody needs insurance, and most people wouldn't possibly be able to understand it. And so,
but then why wouldn't, with freedom of contract, why wouldn't some insurance firms specialize in simple contracts? I assume the usual reason for insurance regulation is that it's a way of transferring money to interest groups that are selling things that you're going to force to be insured. So that if you have people who are in the business of dealing with alcoholism, they will lobby the state insurance regulators to say all insurance has got to include coverage against alcoholism. And similarly for a variety of other things. I know that when my first marriage broke up, I saw a psychologist a few times. And it was sort of nice that the guy would listen to me. It wasn't worth very much, and I would not, if somebody had said to me, I don't remember where my insurance is coming from, probably from my job, if somebody had said to me, will you pay extra for the insurance so that if you're really upset, they'll provide a psychologist to talk to you, I would not pay very much extra. It cost nothing, might as well. So in that sense, but I don't know. I know nothing about California insurance. I'm just turning it, but I can say it's a typical case of how the regulation goes.
But yeah. I guess the gist of it is, if it's a transaction, everyone needs to go through once or many times.
Yeah, but that doesn't give you the argument if there's more than one seller, especially if there are lots of sellers.
Lots of sellers, but I don't know. I guess my problem with that is that it didn't happen, that all insurance contracts were very complex, and they seem to be very simple.
And maybe, but you have to know much more than I know. One reason for complex contracts is that courts aren't willing to enforce simple contracts.
Right. But in this context, they basically are. Like, if you issue someone a 3-page like brochure and you never send them the policy, that brochure is the contract. So any exclusions that aren't on there, like it's a very, very simplistic way of looking at it, where it's the reasonable consumer and then reasonable is way down here somewhere.
But sort of one of the points I make in the chapter is that one of the things that makes contracts longer is the parties not being able to trust the court to try to fill in what the parties would have said. So that if you imagine a court which says, given any doubt, we will decide in favor of the insured, because the insured are sympathetic characters, that would be a reason to have very long and detailed contracts.
It's sort of an offense, because that is the role. You assume that the insured is an idiot, and you construe any ambiguity, even if it isn't really an ambiguity against the insurance company or the drafter, but then at the other end, you can't really make a really long contract unless it's so clearly written that it would be almost impossible.
But if the first was already happening, that would explain why the second would be an issue.
Sure.
I don't know the history of this case, but that would be a reason at least to draw a long contract. So, anyway, let me go on. The first case is unequal bargaining power. What I'm arguing is the mere fact that something is important. After all, insurance is very nice, but you die a lot faster without food. And so you could argue the grocery stores all have unequal bargaining power, and yet I don't know anybody who feels that way about the grocery stores. And the obvious reason is there are lots of different grocery stores, and you can pick them up. But as I say, even in the monopoly case, it really, I think, is only the special case where the freedom of contract increases the amount you can pay for something for which you're willing to pay as much as you got, basically. It's a fairly special, but not existent case. And I mentioned over there the fact that you might get non-optimal contracts in monopoly cases, but that's not really a superior bargaining power. After all, the monopoly is losing through its failure to be able to do perfect price discrimination, too. Then let me go on to the next case, which is the one of real duress. So real duress is your money or your life. And that's another case which to me seems quite interesting, because you've sort of got the three-stage process, where the first step is the obvious economist argument, which says you want to enforce the contract, because after all, you'd rather give him your money than lose your life. And that's the way I put it in the book, is the question, when the mugger says, I want $100, and you say, I've only got $20, and he says, I'll take a check, should you be able to stop payment? And do people follow the two steps, the argument why you shouldn't be and the argument why you should be? Yes? No? Is that all obvious? Yes. What's the argument for saying you should not be able to stop payment? It ought to be an enforceable contract.
Yep.
You don't get killed, right? You're able. You make a deal which you're in favor of. You give up some money. You say, "What's the argument against?"
Then there's going to be more buggings.
Yes. Notice that this is in a sense the opposite of my water in the desert. The effect on the supply of people out in the desert with barrels of water is a good thing, right? Due to their being able to get lots of money. The only bad thing is the result is that somebody ends up enslaved for the rest of his life. Whereas in the case of the mugging, increasing the number of muggings is a bad thing. And then the point, which is, I think, less obvious but interesting, is that there's no theoretical grounds for saying which of these effects is larger. That one can imagine cases if for some reason, let me give you the following mildly science fictional. Let us suppose we have a world where it is practical to kill people and dismember them for organ transplant, sell the organs.
Okay.
What? Maybe. Though I think only the state is doing it, but I'm not sure. But you can certainly imagine a world where you have illegal, and there are urban legends about the guy who wakes up without his kidney in a bathtub after getting drunk in a bar or something. And I don't know if it ever happens, probably not in the U.S., but you can certainly imagine a world where that. Suppose for some reason there was a very inelastic supply of people who would commit this kind of crime. suppose we have a society where most people have moral qualms about doing that sort of thing, and there are only a few people who are actually willing to mug you and dismember, kill you, dismember your organs, and sell them on the black market. And so the number of people doing that won't be very much affected by how much money they can get in the process. In that world, not letting you stop the check might indeed be a desirable arrangement, because in that world, the extra revenue from the fact that you can pay them a little bit more than your body is worth on the hoof in order to stay alive won't much increase the number of these things that happen, but it'll greatly decrease the damage because all you do is pay with money instead of getting killed. Right? Does that make sense? So the basic point I'm making is that the interesting thing about this case and some other economic cases is that you have two effects going in opposite directions. That in one that one effect is the ability to make payments means that in some cases the damage done by the mugging is less. And the other effect is the ability to do give payments means more mugging occurs. And then,
I was curious how it's stick to credit card successful. You know, these days someone steals your credit card, they run up a huge bill, you call your credit card company and say, hey, my credit card was stolen, give me that money back. So the thief still gets money he wants out of it, and you still get your money back.
Yes.
So the credit card company's out.
Yes.
Like, how does that change this analysis at all? I guess because then it's still going opposite directions, but then this side's just the credit card company, both of you going this way.
Well, but in that case, then you know, with a thief stealing your credit card, there's no benefit to just being able to use the money. And indeed, if the equivalent here is are you able, as soon as it's stolen, to suspend the payment? And to some degree, you can.
Depending
on calling.
So, they take your phone, for example.
That's right. So in that situation, you're better off, and the credit card company is better off, and only the thief is worse off, right? Because it's not like the thief is saying, give me your credit card and I won't kill you. But no, the two cases that struck me as realistic cases in this. One of them, I came across at some point an article on the institution of parole in Europe prior to Napoleon. And it was really quite interesting because apparently, parole, P-A-R-O-L-E,
prior to the
Napoleon, is broke down during the Napoleonic Wars, it turns out. It's quite interesting. But the old system is that you're having a war, and we've captured you, and we will suppose for a moment you're an officer. I'm not sure to what extent this is going to work for the ordinary people. And the French officer says to the English officer, Monsieur, the town jail is over there, and if you wish, we will put you in it. But it's really not a very pleasant place for a gentleman like you to spend his time. But if you will give me your parole is the French word for word. So if you'll give me your promise not to try escape, the inn is over at the other end of town, and the proprietor of the inn is a fine cook, and I assume being a gentleman, you probably have some money to pay her with. So as long as you will promise not to try to escape, we will not insist on chaining you or putting you in a cell. I'll drop by to, have lunch with you every once in a while, and eventually you will be exchanged for a French officer of the same rank, or perhaps this war will end. And that was a standard arrangement. But it was carried further, because in some occasions, the French officers, the English officer, Monsieur, much as I have enjoyed your company, I am sure that your wife would like to have you back. And I have been authorized to make you the following offer. If you will give me your parole not to rejoin your army and fight against France until you have been exchanged for an officer of similar rank, the ship is over there, you can go back to England. And these were socially enforceable contracts. I don't think there was any court mechanism. But if you gave your parole, went back to England to rejoin the army, and people found out about it, they would fuck you. They would regard you as a dishonest person who had cheated, in part because it's dishonorable for a gentleman to break his word, but probably in part also because the result of your doing that is if they're captured, they won't be able to go home because the French will find out about it. So that was a system. And it seems to me that that was a case in which it was a contract made under duress. My promise not to rejoin the army under the duress of being a prisoner of the French, or my promise not to run away under the duress of throwing me in jail otherwise. It was a contract that was in fact enforceable, although only by moral and social sanctions. The fact that the contract was enforceable and occurred made war less costly. might therefore probably increase the amount of work. But it seems to be quite likely that the benefit from having people able to go home instead of locked up in a jail was larger than the cost from having a few more people captured because of the force. Right. That's so that is, yeah.
Well, I would just add to that that yeah. I feel like if it wasn't the aristocratic class that was benefiting most from it, that I don't know it. Like, yeah, it probably costs money to, like, hold officers, but officers have more influence in their country. So there's a disproportionate increase in the amount of war. Like, people don't think of it as war. The people with power don't think of it as warfare.
I don't know whether the parole... The problem was not so much they didn't like non-officers, they didn't trust them.
Right, yeah, yeah.
That the sort of same social sanctions wouldn't have worked. They wouldn't have been as visible. So. But then the final case is the one that I have in the book, which was fairly recent when I wrote the book. I don't know if any of you still remember it, but it was the Pinochet case. And that struck me as particularly interesting, because Augusto Fuen Pinochet took power in Chile in a military coup. He ruled over Chile for a noticeable while. During the time he ruled, it is asserted very likely correctly that various people were arrested, secretly murdered, and so forth. I think the scale of it was pretty small, if you compare it to people like Stalin and Hitler and Pol Pot that you're talking about. Hundreds, not millions, or even hundreds of thousands of people. But still large enough so that on ordinary criminal grounds, one could see grounds for locking him up or executing him. And what's interesting and unusual about Pinochet is that he peacefully gave up power. There was not a rebellion going on, although I'm sure there was some discontent with his rule, but he made a deal with whoever were the people in position with the next election, I guess, which said, we will reestablish democratic government in Chile, but we've got a condition. And the condition is you agree that I and the people who worked for me will be immunized against any penalties for the things we did during the time. And that was agreed to by the Chilean government, and Pinochet indeed gave up power, and from then until now, Chile has had a democratic government. And eventually, Pinochet had medical problems which resulted in his going to England for treatment. And there was a Spanish judge who, if I remember correctly, claimed very likely correctly that there had been a few Spanish citizens in Chile who had been killed by Pinochet during his that therefore he felt he had jurisdiction over the case, and he asked to have Pinochet extradited to Spain to be tried for his crimes. And he didn't get extradited to Spain. I never followed the case carefully enough to be sure quite why he didn't, whether it was one of these cases where he's very sick, he's dying, so he'll do it, or Chile has first claim on it or something, but in any case, it didn't happen. But it struck me as an interesting question from just this case, because it's got exactly the same logic as the case we discussed before. That on the one hand, making agreements to immunize ex-dictators and their bully boys from their crimes reduces the cost while you're a dictator of killing people. But refusing to enforce that immunization greatly increases the cost of giving up power. And Pinochet did give up power. And there's always the problem in any of these cases of the after-the-fact nature. They will look, he's given a power, we don't have to worry about that anymore. Now we can violate the rule, but of course there will be another dictator, 10 years down the road, and to the extent that one establishes precedents that one isn't willing to enforce these things, that maybe you can't establish precedents. But anyway, it was going to be sort of an intriguing case of exactly the same tension. That to our intuition, don't enforce contracts made under duress seems perfectly reasonable, just no argument against it. And yet, there is an argument. There's an argument both for enforcing and for not enforcing. So that seems to be the case, which is why I discussed it in some way. Right. The next interesting case is the sinking ship. That's the one that I think I quote up for a couple. I call it semi-duress or something. And that, again, is getting closer to... Indeed, logically, that's pretty close to my water in the desert. The difference being that paying the full value of a ship doesn't have quite the same unattractive features as selling yourself into slavery, so to speak. But you will notice, were people able to follow the logic of the sinking ship or not? Because it's a little complicated. The question you want to ask is, what is the efficient price? And the answer is no. There isn't an efficient price. That there are two different, the price is the payment on two different margins. right? The price paid by the sinking ship for being towed by the tugboat is on the one hand the incentive to the tug, and on the other hand it's the penalty to the ship for getting into trouble, for being in a position that needed to be towed. The optimal penalty to the ship for being into getting into trouble is the cost that the ship getting into trouble imposes, which is the time and fuel of the tugboat to tug it back safely. The optimal incentive for the tugboat to be there in order to rescue the ship is the full value of the ship. Because that's what the gain is when you rescue a sinking ship. So therefore, the one argument implies that the price paid for the tugboat ought to be the full value of the ship, the other that it ought to be only the tugboat's cost. People follow that argument? Yes? No?
He gets a ship and he does a salvage maritime law thing.
Except that it's a bargain agreement. That is, I'm discussing if you have freedom of contract. Now, under salvage and maritime law, it's not that simple. I mean, as I'm saying in the book, Admiralty Court gets to set the price, in effect, if they don't like the price that was set. But suppose you just think of it as a freely bargained contract. In that case, the reason they get the ship is that the agent of the ship says, I'm willing to pay you $10 million to tow this ship to shore, at least $9.5 million or something, because it's better than sinking. That's the argument, basically. And what I'm saying is that that's a case where you've got a very simple reason for saying that the bargain price is going to be optimal, and there really isn't an optimal price. There's one price that gives one person the right incentive, and a different price that gives a different person the right incentive. Now, you could imagine an optimal pricing structure is that you could imagine something more complicated than payment for rescuing. You could imagine something in which the shipping company pays the tug some annual fee for agreeing to man its radio 24 hours a day and to go out whenever there's a storm and so forth. So you could imagine a more elaborate contractual form which adjusted everybody's incentives. But if all you're considering is that all we're doing is the contract only comes into existence when the ship's going down and the tug shows up, and they then agree on a price, that that's a case in which the standard argument of freedom of contract really doesn't work. And it has the problem that it's a bilateral monopoly bargain. You're facing tight time constraints. If you pull it too tight, you know, just like the problem in union management bargainings, where if you keep your strike going too long, you might bankrupt the company and you're both worse off. But on the other hand, if you stop it too early, you're going to give in to them. You don't want to do that. So you've got problems. So there's at least some argument for saying we'll settle this by having a neutral third party called the Admiralty Court, and you can bargain if you like, but you can then get them to revise the bargain if it's far enough from what they need. So that's the basic argument. And then the final form of what one might think of as duress, which is contracts of adhesion, which is form contracts, I at least argue is not duress, there's nothing wrong with it, that it's perfectly reasonable that Hertz should not negotiate each separate contract, it would cost them a great deal, that they offer standard contracts, you take it or leave it, but those standard contracts are not designed in their interest in the sense of making each individual term in their interest. They're designed in their interest in the sense of making the terms the ones that maximize their total profit, which depends not only on how much the terms cost them, but on how valuable the contract is to you and that's what they're paying for. So that's the basic argument. Alright, let me go on to the question of filling in the blanks, or going back a step. If you ask why we need courts at all, maybe I sort of skipped in my outline, maybe I shouldn't have skipped it, then sort of the first question after you ask why we need contracts is, why don't we just enforce the contract as written? What do we need any contract law for? Just, you know, read the thing and do it. And one answer might be that courts don't approve of all contracts, don't want to enforce some of them. Another answer is that we have to figure out whether there is a contract. I wrote down this detailed set of rules and I showed it to you, and you say, yeah, but I never agreed to it. And I'm just imagining there's some possibility that we'll be spending next fall quarter somewhere else, and there's still we'll have to find something house in the house, and you can imagine something in which I write out a 3-page set of instructions about house sitting. You know, keep an eye on the fruit trees, and if they're looking brown, then readjust the sprinkler system, and this is what you do with the cats, and so forth and so on. And you can certainly imagine how Sue said, oh, thanks, that was, you know, very useful information. And then he fails to do some of it, and I sued. He said, well, I never signed a contract. I thought that when you agreed to house it after I showed you what you were supposed to be doing, you would agree, no, that was useful advice on what you wanted me to do. Right? So one issue courts have decided is there a contract? One of them is, do they want that contract to be enforced? And a third one is filling in the blanks. Because, you know, given the complication of the world, there's never enough small print to really cover all possible cases. And why might they not want to enforce it at all? Well, one obvious set of reasons we've just been running through, namely arguments for why contract, arguments against freedom of contract. There's two other arguments against freedom of contract I mentioned in the chapter, and they're sort of pretty obvious. One of them is that the contract imposes the cost on third parties, such as hiring hitman, not an enforceable contract under our law. Another one is that they believed that one of the parties wasn't a responsible and rational person because he was in an insane asylum at the time. He was a 5-year-old at the time or something. Those aren't very interesting, but those are understandable reasons. But then the filling in the blanks gets again interesting because the question is, you're a court. There is a dispute over the contract. Once the dispute arises, of course, one party said, well, of course, the implied term here that we didn't say was this. This is not only the implied term, it was that. All right. How should the court decide? You're a judge. There is a dispute over the contract. It is a dispute that could have been resolved if they had bothered to write a longer contract filling in that particular unlikely contingency, but they didn't. How do you as a judge decide how to rule? Yep.
One solution is whatever is normally accepted by most people as being the meaning of the words.
I'm not thinking of meaning issues. I mean, that's a different question, because even they do specify your favorite words mean. But I was thinking rather of some contingency that was not covered in the contract at all.
Okay. So I guess then maybe what would be against whoever wrote the contract?
That's a common legal rule, yeah.
Common industry practices.
Might be, you might know that, yeah.
Better to protect themselves.
Who can
bear the cost more?
So that means you always decide in favor of the poorer party, in which case poor parties will find they have to pay high prices in order to get people signed contracts with them if they know the contract will always be resolved in their favor. How about,
just kind of trying to glean the intent.
They didn't cover it. I don't know how you glean the intent. What are the suggestions?
What? I already said it's part of the industry practice.
Those are all things people might do. But the answer, at least that I would argue for, is you want to figure out what they would have written if they had put it in. And how do you figure that out now that we've got the first half of the chapter? What term would they have written if they had considered this a contingency? How do we answer that? You're drafting a contract. You are considering a contingency. What question do you ask yourself in deciding what terms to write on this contract? That's a pretty good question. That's right. You would ask what term would maximize the sum benefits of the parties. That's the term they will try to design. And therefore, if they have left the question blank, that's the term that you impose on it. And that has two virtues. One of them is that under most circumstances, those are also the best terms, because usually the contract mainly only affects the two parties, so you're maximizing your benefit is a good thing. But the other thing is, the other thing, which is a bad thing, of course, from the standpoint of all of you people, but not the rest of the world, is that that reduces the demand for lawyers, because if I know that the court won't try to write what I would write, that increases my incentive to write a longer contract. Right? If I say, obviously, if we had specified what happens if my cat gets out while your cat's sitting, or while your house sitting, we would have specified that you have to put up some signs around the neighborhood, you have to spend an hour or so wandering around the backyard calling kitty, 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 and put out some cat food by the back door and check that every half an hour. We would not have specified that you have to spend all your time for the next 3 weeks searching the neighborhood for the lost cat. And if we believe either that the court will say you have no obligation at all because it wasn't in, or say you were in charge of the house, you have an absolute obligation to do everything possible to retrieve that cat, especially because the judge is a cat lover. If we suspect either of those terms, that's a reason why we should include in the contract the detailed statement of what happens if the cat gets out. Make sense? So therefore, following the rule of try to impose efficient terms has as one of its advantages reducing the cost of going out contracts to parties. And that goes back to the point I was making earlier about my guesses about the insurance cases, though I don't really know if it's true or not. All right. We then discuss as one of those issues the allocation of risk, which could be either an issue for drawing up the contract or for filling in the blanks, depending whether or not it was included. And that's basically the issue that we spent a good deal of time a month or so ago on with regard to economics and insurance. Right? So we're allocating risks. How do we decide which of two parties we should allocate a particular risk to? What are the relevant considerations? Whoever is in the best position to avoid it, what do we call that in the insurance context?
That was the low-cost avoider?
Moral, that's the moral hazard issue. All right. Whoever is in the best position to control the cost. What is the second? We've got three considerations which neatly match the three considerations in the insurance discussion. So one issue is that you would like the person to bear the cost who is in the best position to prevent it, because if Mary has an incentive to prevent it. What's the second issue? What? Second issue or third issue could be, but yes, second issue is risk aversion. And so risk aversion says all else be equal, the person is in the best position to self-insure in the best position to spread losses. So if the contractor is a company that's building 100 houses a month and I'm a single homeowner, that's an argument for putting the risk of the house burning down while it's being built on him rather than on me, because he can spread that risk and therefore doesn't have a risk aversion cost added to the house. Does that make sense?
How exactly spread that risk?
Among the other, he's building 100 houses. Okay. So therefore, he knows one house out of 100 will suppose burns down when thinking 1,000 houses, thinking one house out of 100 burns down. So any given year, he's got between 8 and 12 houses burning down. That's a predictable constant cost to him. Whereas to you, it's a one chance in 100 of losing your life savings. Right? So risk aversion, thinking, I got, what's the third basis? We've got three possible grounds in insurance for three issues that arise with insurance. What's the third? Adverse selection. And what does adverse selection imply in terms of who ought to bear a risk in a contract?
I don't understand.
Anybody else?
The person with the information?
The person who's in the best position to measure the risk. Because if you do it that way, the issue now is signing contracts you shouldn't sign. That if we have a case where there is a risk of the house burning down, and imagine now it's just one contractor who builds one house, and a homeowner who wants one house, either of them will be devastated by the loss of the house burning down, so we don't have that basis for deciding it. Maybe that would be a reason to divide the loss or something. But another question is, which of them has to get better? Because suppose the builder knows that this is a 10% chance, and the homeowner has no idea. And suppose that if there is a 10% chance, suppose that if there was no chance, the house is worth $100,000 to the owner. And the homeowner says, if you'll build it for me for $98,000, we have a deal. But in fact, if he's the one who bears the cost of the fire burning down, he's only getting they get a 10% chance, right? He's only getting $90,000 because he's getting a 10% chance of a pile of cinders and a 90% chance of the house. So he's paying $98,000 for a $90,000 house. That contractor never even signed. On the other hand, if the builder knows the odds, the builder says to himself, I'm being paid $100,000. The homeowner, that being $98,000. For that $98,000, the homeowner either gets a house or he gets his money back because I'm the one who's responsible for the risk. So he knows what to do. And I know that I am getting $98,000 minus a 10% chance of having to bear the cost of the house burning down. So I know what I'm getting, and I know whether the cost of me of building the house is low enough so that deals with me. Make sense? So that, you know, or just like buying a used car, buying and selling a used car, the person who knows the odds can set a price which is worth doing for him. The person who doesn't know the odds can't tell whether it is or is not worth doing the transaction. So that would suggest that in allocating risk in a contract, you want to think of three things, which in the insurance context you can think of as moral hazard, adverse selection, and risk spreading. If they all point the same way, you're home free, but just as in the case we were discussing before with regard to contracts under duress, you could imagine cases where one of them goes one direction and the other goes the other direction, and in that you'd have to make some kind of a judgment on which was more important in order to decide to do it. And next we come to breach. What's the rule for efficient breach? When should a contract be breached?
When following the contract costs more than breaching the contract.
For more to who?
To the breaching party.
That's when the breaching party would like to breach it, but when should it be breached?
That's to both parties.
To both parties, right? It's a vicious breach when breach results in a net benefit rather than a net cost. So if circumstances change so that my completion of the contract is worth $50,000 to you, but completing it will cost me $100,000, breach is now efficient. All right? What are the ways we could arrange things to get efficient breach and only efficient breach? Just help to read the chapter first. How do we get efficient breach and only efficient breach? Anybody? How do we get efficient breach? How do we set up a contract so that it will be breached if there are net advantages to do so and not otherwise?
Where each party only needs to know the risk, their own risk of breach.
Now, there are basically two answers which go exactly with our property versus liability rules. One answer is if you have low transaction costs, then practically anything will do it. If you have low transaction costs, if the rule is I can breach without any penalty at all, then if I want to breach in a case where breaching saves me $50,000 and costs you $100,000, you offer me $60,000 not to breach. All right, be clear. So with zero transaction costs, either a rule of no enforceable contracts or a rule of specific performance, which is, do you see how both no enforceable contracts and specific performance are both really property rules in the same sense we discussed before? What's the difference between the two? Considered as property rules, what's the difference between saying the contract is unenforceable and saying you have to fulfill the contract? Are cars controlled by a property rule? In order for you to drive my car, what do you have to do? In order for you to drive your car, what do you have to do? Yes. So in other words, what's the difference between your car and my car? Other than the fact that mine is bigger than yours.
A property rule?
They're both property rules.
Right.
What's the difference between the two?
I don't know.
Whose property it is?
Right.
Right. Same rule. Similarly, a non-enforceable contract means that the right to breach belongs to the breaching party. And the specific performance rule means that the right to breach belongs to the party that breaches again. Does that make sense? Just like, in terms of the standard property rule thing, both my, with low transaction costs, both my car and your car will be used efficiently by both of us. All right, my car is a very nice minivan. I don't know what your car is, but I'm going to assume for the moment your car is a plain sports car. And now, if you need to go somewhere with six or seven people, you make me an offer. You say, I'll let you drive my snazzy sports car if I can borrow your minivan for the weekend. It's in both of our interests to do that if it happens efficiently. And if I need your sports car, same thing is going to apply. So whichever of us it belongs to in a zero transaction rule, we get the efficient outcome. All right? So, similarly, in a zero transaction world, if the right to breach belongs to the person who wants to breach, as long as transaction costs are low, we get the efficient outcome because I don't breach unless you're unwilling to offer me enough to make me not breach. And the only reason you're not willing to offer me enough to make me not breach is that the cost to you of breach is less than the benefit to me. Make sense? Doesn't make sense? And turn it around. If I need your permission to breach, the same thing is true. I'll still breach if it's efficient because then I'll be willing to offer you enough to, so you'll let me breach. Who has to pay whom is different in the two cases. They're both efficient results. But both of those depend on low transaction costs and in general property rights over liability rights make sense when transaction costs are low. It's worth noticing that property shows up in the law and in law and economics in lots of different contexts. So that property rights versus liability rights are not the same issue as property versus commons. In commons, you don't have either property right or liability right. What's the other way of getting efficient breach? Suppose we live in a world where the transaction costs are high. How do we arrange contracts to get efficient breach? Compensate the other party enough so that he is as well off as if there had been no breach, just like making something whole. Right? And under that, in that situation, I will only breach if the savings to me of breaching is greater than the loss to you, because I'm going to pay you the loss. All right, make sense? Yes? No? Does it make sense? The straight Pigouvian tax argument, correct?
In that situation, well, considering the cost of litigation as transaction costs?
No. That's, in general, property rules work perfectly if transaction costs of buying and selling and borrowing stuff are zero. And liability rules work perfectly if litigation works perfectly, which means it's costless and accurate. And that suggests that one of the limitations to the expectations damage rule is it requires that the court can figure out how much you lost due to the breach. There's a further problem, which I'm not going to go into, because if you didn't read it carefully enough to have the most fundamental points, probably look at the subtle points, and you can go through them later, but it turns out that the expectation rule gives the wrong incentive to rely, where rely means make expenditures which make sense only if there's no breach. Because with the expectation rule, you get the payoff from the expenditure even if there is a breach because the other guy's got to make you good, and therefore you decide whether to engage in reliance expenditures if there was zero chance of breaching. And there's another rule set called reliance damages, which you would think solved that problem in his name, but doesn't. And the difference is, theoretically, the difference is that expectation damages give you your lost profit, makes you as well off as if the contract was completed, and reliance damages repay your reliance, which means makes you as well off as if the contract never been signed. and I try to sketch why there might be some advantage of lion's damage in there, but it's a somewhat complicated argument. But neither of them solves the problem of inefficient reliance, which is that either of them, if I spend money retooling my factory, I don't have to worry that that's money down the drain if you breach. Because if you breach, you're going to have to compensate. What does solve that problem is liquidated damages, which is the one where we agree in a fixed amount that you're going to owe me if you breach. I don't get any more when I rely, and the money I spent on the new factory I spent. So with liquidated damages, I make the right decision about whether to retool my factory to produce what you ordered. And the problem with liquidated damages, of course, is they require us to estimate what expectation damages would be before the breach occurs, and therefore we have less information than that.
Yep.
But what would be the difference between liquidated damages and a penalty clause? Just a question of...
Yes, a penalty clause is large liquidated damages. The penalty clause is liquidated damages which the court thinks are unreasonably large, which the court thinks are not an estimate of expectations. And the one thing wrong in the discussion of that in the book, when I make the point that a penalty clause is really a contractually agreed to property rule, because it says you can't break it without the other guy's permission unless you get a lot. The one difference between that and an ordinary property rule is that an ordinary property rule, if I take your car without your permission, I pay a very large fine, but you don't get that fine, which changes your incentives as opposed to the case of a penalty clause where if I breach the contract and can't get your permission, then I got to pay the penalty clause. Or I could also pay whatever the costs are of not breaching the contract. All right, I think we're out of time now, and we will return to some of this stuff, and I hope you enjoy the China from China to Cyberspace article, and I think we're also, if I remember correctly, going on to a different and even more important kind of contracting, namely the contract that you will sign with a woman for spending the rest of your life with her, assuming you are so lucky as to find a suitable contractual partner.